better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3544 of the Survival Podcast. And today's episode is called Urban Ditch Fishing as a Survival Skill. As always, we are running live streams on YouTube and Rumble and places like that. And our live stream will remain available when we're done as a archive video. So I wanted to say something up front that I don't usually talk about for people who might find this video on a place like YouTube later on. This is a podcast. If you clicked on this video link to see people fishing under a bridge or something, we're going to talk about it today. We're not going to do it. That said, there may be a lot to learn from it, but it's not going to be some dude getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, rolling out in his truck and catching fish out of a ditch. That's not what we're doing today. We are a podcast and we do podcasting. And so that's what we're going to do. And we're going to go through a bunch of stuff today. I am going to cover things today like what ditch fishing even means, because it's not always actually a ditch. It's a term that we use, why it's a survival skill. I'm going to tell you how to find locations. I'm going to tell you there's probably a place like I'm talking about within 10 to 15 miles of your house, unless you live smack in the middle of the desert. There's probably something like this. And the more you live toward an urban, suburban town, even like a good sized town, the more likely it is that you have tons of places like this. Many you've driven past and never even noticed. I'm going to talk about, once you find a location, how to check it out. Some of the most common target species throughout most of the United States. It will be kind of sort of southern United States centric to a degree there, because that's where I've spent the most of my time. I did grow up in Pennsylvania, but most of the fishing I did in streams and stuff up there were for trout, and they were stock streams. It certainly has helped me, and I may reference it a bit, but I've spent most of my life in Florida and Texas. If you combine those two, more than 80% of my life's been in the southern United States. So that is what I'm most familiar with, but this will work anywhere. I'll talk about why, just real briefly. If you're new to this, because again, you found me on YouTube and you're not familiar with my podcast, I do a lot with what's called aquaculture, which means I'm growing fish right in my backyard. And honestly, the majority of the fish that I catch, if I keep them, come home alive and they go into one of my tanks. And I call them bait tanks if I talk to a rabbit sheriff. We'll talk maybe a little bit about that and a little why it's a case. The basic gear that you need and might want to have, I'm not going to get advanced here on any of the gear because that defeats the whole thing. And then we're going to talk about, when you find a good spot, some things to look for. I actually have some YouTube videos pulled up and just on a still screen. So if you're listening to the audio only, like most of you do, you may want to look this video up and at least jump into the part where I go through that. Because the other thing I'm going to be doing today is I'm actually going to go through, using Google Maps, a couple places I'm actually familiar with. They're right around me, or I used to live there. And I've got an area pulled up for Nashville and Atlanta, right? And I know nothing about those places. And I'm going to show you how quickly you can use something like Google Maps to find locations to fish. And we will be talking, too, about things like park ponds and stuff like that, because it's not always a ditch. Again, I'll explain what ditch fishing really means here in just a moment. And we will be having an interesting show today, I hope, and definitely a fun one. For those that are new to the show or just found me or whatever, I love to fish. People that have listened to my show since 2008 when we launched know that. Like, I get excited when I talk about this, and it doesn't matter if I'm talking about going out with a guide in South Florida and we're catching freaking Goliath groupers, which up until about 10 years ago was on my bucket list to do. Or hiking back in the mountains and fishing for native trout, or busting white bass and stripers out of one of these big lakes here in Texas, or ditch fishing. And in some ways, I enjoy ditch fishing more than everything else, because I think inside all of us is the kid that we were. Like, that kid dies and doesn't die as we grow into men or to women if we're female. We kind of move on in our life, but yet we're still the 10-year-old that did this in Jacksonville, Florida, which was me, right? You were still the 14-year-old that did it in rural Pennsylvania, which was me. We're still that person. And I think that sometimes when we do the things we did when we were kids and we just let ourselves enjoy them, we can reconnect with that. So I get really, really excited about this. I know it won't be one of my most popular episodes. It'll probably end up with around 50-ish in the live stream at our peak versus several hundred like we had yesterday when we talked about gloom and doom and artificial intelligence. The audio downloads will, you know, bust in half down. We'll be lucky if we break 100,000 downloads on the audio. But for those who tune in, you're going to learn a vital survival skill if we ever end up into a point where food is short. And we'll talk about pollution, because before we even started, we had somebody that had to do it, and I knew it would happen. The freak said, oof, most fresh water is severely polluted in March and not to consume. We'll talk about, you know, what does that really mean? What is it really from? And why actually this form of fishing, when you pick the right location, might actually be better than a lot of lakes that people eat fish out of all the time. Additionally, again, we will bring the aquaculture component into this, because I promise you, the places that I fish like this right now, I've never brought a fish home and ate it the day that I brought it home. Sometimes I held it into my big old bait tank, which is like 5,000 gallons, for a year or more. And that fish is as clean as any fish you're going to eat anywhere, because it's, you know, living in water that comes out of a 160-foot deep limestone well, and it only eats what I put in that water. So anyway, let's dig all into it. I want to remind you guys, if you have any questions, comments, etc., the way to do that is to put the word question or a comment, if it's something you want me to comment back on, in all caps in the live stream, and I just might see it, and I just might mark it, and I just might take it at the end. If you don't do it, I won't see it. Somebody referred to me recently as a cross-eyed podcaster. Ain't nothing wrong with my right eye, and I can't see out of my left eye. I'm not cross-eyed, I'm just blind in one eye, and that just makes it harder for me to do this when I'm on my own versus having a guest or working with a crew or something like that doing the show. All right, so before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Neither of them have anything to do with fishing, but they are cool people who support this show and have for a long time. Number one today has been supporting us for over a decade. Yes, over a decade. I picked up JM Bullion as a sponsor when I moved here to Nine Mile Farm back in 2012. It was right around 2012 I picked these guys up. So they've been a sponsor for 12 years. And if you want to stack silver, then you should do the following. You should get it from somebody who supports the show you love, sells the silver and gold for less than their competitors, ships all orders for free, and if you're a member of my program, gives you a discount. I don't know why you would deal with anybody else. JM Bullion is a company you can trust. We've worked with them forever. I always point out I can get in touch with the president of the company. His name is Michael, if there's ever a problem. But the last time I had to get in touch with Michael over a problem was somewhere around 8 years ago. So it just doesn't happen anymore. What I want to tell you about that, though, because I haven't mentioned this in a long time, back when I first started working with JM Bullion, there were some customer service problems that popped up. I would say about once a month I would get some sort of a heat email from a listener who said, I dealt with them and this thing happened that I am not happy about. Michael Whitmer, who is the president of JM Bullion, every time I contacted him with a customer service problem, do you know what he said? The most wonderful thing you could have in that situation said by an owner of a company. Thank you, and I will fix it. He wasn't just willing to fix the problem. He was happy that somebody who could directly get to him, because the company is big enough with standard, you know, customer service reps probably sitting at a desk somewhere with a headset on that are reading a script. Like, he wanted to know about problems and not have them filtered out. That's why there aren't any more. Great partner, and it's a good idea in our world to have a plan B, a plan C, a plan D, and a plan E when it comes to your finances. And one of those should be occupied by precious metals. The next today is Above Phone, where you can take back your technology and use a phone that actually puts you first instead of stealing from you, like where you are, your demographic, all your information. That's what every single, you know, smartphone is doing. It's smart about how it spies on you. Your provider is spying on you. That'd be AT&T and, you know, T-Mobile or whoever. The device manufacturer, Apple, Android, et cetera, is spying on you. But more than anything else, it's the app manufacturers who spy on you collect your data, and sell it to other people, including your government. You want that to stop? Go to Above Phone, pick up a phone. If you're a member in my program, $75 off any phone there. What's the cost of my membership? $50 a year. 1.5 years covered just by one discounter from the MSB, and you can take back your tech. And the beautiful thing with the apps is you have your own private app ecosystem. You install those apps, and you do everything that you normally would do, except the apps don't spy on you. Let's say you did need an app, though, that is only available in Google Play or the Apple App Store, something like that. Well, you can make a little jail for it, and you put it in its little jail on your phone, and it only can do the thing that it does, which you accepted because you decided it was worth it when you let it actually function. Otherwise, it stays in its jail and it can't do anything. How cool is that? And if you're thinking, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I'll be able to handle a new tech system. I don't know if I've got it in me. You can. I promise you, you can do it because Above Phone will give you a walkthrough in converting over to your new phone. Now, let's get into this. All right. About all of this stuff with ditch fishing. So what I want to start out with, and I want to remind you guys on Rumble, I can see you on this other computer, but it's also where my notes are. So I will check in on your live chat from time to time. But if you want any kind of response from me, it is absolutely imperative. Question or comment in all caps. That's best everywhere, but it's really important if you're going to comment from Rumble. So what is ditch fishing? And why isn't it always actually a ditch? Ditch fishing is a term that I don't even really know exactly when it originated, but it really means any little small kind of forgotten body of water that most people wouldn't fish in. That's really all it means. So it can be a little park pond that nobody thinks any fish are in, but it can often be loaded with fish. It can be a literal ditch, a canal, a stranded water system on a highway median is often a great place to fish, believe it or not. And we'll talk more about this, but what I'm really talking about is when you have a creek that runs through an area and you have kind of like a ponded area that water back floods up to when water's high. And then when that creek drops back down, often those fish get caught up in that location and they can't get out and they're captive and they become really a great place to fish. In Florida, where I vacation, I'm there with my wife. We're going to the beach. I'm going to be fishing for, you know, sea trout and redfish and stuff like that. So I don't ever bother. But, man, if I live there, I see these canals everywhere, and I know they're loaded with fish because I grew up in part of northern Florida. And they have, you know, invasive species, which are awesome, like snakeheads and cichlids and peacock bass and all kinds of cool shit. And I know people are like, they're not awesome, Jack. They're invasive species. I get it. But they're awesome for you if you're the one catching them, and no one cares how many you take. So there's a ton of opportunity here, and it's always just looking for these little pockets of ignored water. That's really what it's about. And sometimes that means you end up in things that look more like a small river than a creek. It all depends on what you can find. And so what it does, though, is it forces you to kind of get out of your bubble and look around where you live, and that opens up a lot of things that we're going to talk about from a survival skill situation, because this is the survival podcast and we talk about preparedness. Well, one of the most overlooked aspects of preparedness, I got my beans, my bullets, and my band-aids. I'm ready for the apocalypse. Those people are generally, if what they're preparing for actually happens, they're probably dead fast. They have no idea really what a breakdown looks like. Okay. And one of the biggest overlooked things is generally breakdowns look like what you see right now, with shortages and more dangers than typical. Okay? That's what they look. They don't look like the book that you read about the Russian guy who got rich and bought a bunch of nuclear weapons and got on a submarine and put the lights out all over North America. That's not what breakdowns look like. And lawless freaking motorcycle guys raging everywhere and killing that's just not historically what breakdowns have looked like. That's not what unravelings, that's not what fourth turnings have looked like. And so what gets overlooked is situational awareness. What's around you? Where are the resources? Where are the dangers? Who are the people you need to look out for? Where do bad things already happen? Because when you get a stressed out situation where bad things happen, more bad things happen. Where things are adjacent to where bad things happen, more bad things happen. So I don't want to go too deep into this because it's a fishing show, but just get the point. When you get out and you actually move around the area that's, let's say, 10 to 25 minutes from your house is as far as most of you will have to go to find a dozen places like this. Again, if you live in the middle of the desert in Arizona, okay, you got me. But most of the country where like 85 to 90% of the people live, that's the case. Well, now you'll know a lot more about what's around you just because you're getting involved. And this would be true of a lot of things like geocaching and stuff like that, not just fishing. But food close to home is a great thing to know about. So thoughts on pollution. Number one, if you ended up where you literally needed to do this to feed yourself, you'll deal with the fact that it might not be the cleanest food known to man. And you're better off eating it than starving. So just bluntly, like if that's where we really went to with this. I'm not suggesting you go out and start filleting fish every day out of a ditch off of a major highway down the street from a chemical factory. Okay? That's not what I'm suggesting at all. Again, I do a lot of aquaculture, so I like to catch fish that are just a little smaller, but legal one way or another. Then what I really want for a table fish, bring it home. And it spends 3 months to a year in a fish farming environment. So I'm way less worried about that because that gives these fish time to clean out their systems, to grow, et cetera. And I don't eat them a tremendous amount of time either. You know, if we eat fish from the backyard, probably 2 to 3 times a month. That's about it. All right. And sometimes we go months without eating any at all. In fact, right now I'm at a point where we're eating almost none because there's not that many out there, and it's about time to start restocking because this is actually a great time of year to do this too. That's another reason we're doing this today. It's also a low-tech environment. You never hear somebody, I'm going ditch fishing. Let me get my Hummingbird 17th generation deep wide sonar. Like, that's not it. Let me load up my $50,000 bass boat, attach my $75,000 loaded F-150 to it, get my $5,000 worth of tackle. Like that's not what we're talking about. A lot of this can be done with a little kit you can carry in your pocket. I recommend a little bit more than that, but it's a low-tech environment, which improves your overall survival skills, including in wilderness applications. A creek is a creek is a creek, and a fish is a fish in a fish. And learning how to identify pocket water where fish hold is valuable, and it translates. You're probably not going to spend all your time in the wilderness fishing these remote creeks with pristine water. So if you want to develop the skill, you need repetition. And then when you're there, you actually have the repetition, the muscle memory, the mindset, et cetera. We'll talk more about that as we go on today, too, because there will be some Jack Kidd stories and things that happened in my past in today's episode. Water and plants are resources too. And what I mean by that is a good idea to know where water is. I'm not going to drink the polluted water. No one told you to, but you could filter it and drink it if you had to. But if we end up in a long-term grid down scenario, that water can do a lot more for you than just, let's say, be water you can cook with or whatever. You should store as much water as you can. But, you know, if you have plants you need to keep alive, it's a source of irrigation. If you have livestock you need to keep alive, well, damn it, they're going to drink it anyway because my ducks drink water they poop in every day anyway. There's a lot of times when maybe that water, well, how am I going to get water from? You're going to get a little bilge pump and something like a bladder from before, and then you can pump water into your truck and bring it home. If you do that, this is not really about fish. Just know where it is. I'm not going to go deep into it today. Water's effing heavy. So really make sure you – whatever your truck can carry, you carry half that weight or less because water moves around, even in a bladder, okay? It forces improvisation and hacks. No matter how prepared you think you are, when you start fishing like this, you are going to get into situations where, like, damn, I didn't bring a bobber, and if I could just float this line down around that bank, I know I just can feel, I can't really access it without falling in the mud or something, but I know there's fish down around that corner. Well, I mean, when I was a kid, that exact thing happened to me, and I just took a piece of a tree, cut into both sides of it with a knife, kind of pulled the line into it. If you lose it, I don't care. I didn't buy it from Walmart. There's 3 million of them right there and was able to float down there. Also, on that particular situation, it was a deep cutout bank that went around. It was a brook trout is what I was targeting in this particular creek. And there were grasshoppers everywhere. So I went and caught a couple grasshoppers and put a small hook on them and floated them with that bobber down around the corner. That's just one of like hundreds of things that I've come up with over the years. I actually have a book I never finished that was just all those little type of like guerrilla hacks and things that you can do fishing. Well, this leads you to them. You'll figure them out yourselves. It improves your fishing skills overall. Setting a hook is setting a hook. Recognizing a strike is recognizing a strike. Seeing pocket water is seeing pocket water. Knowing where to fish and where not to fish, that translates no matter what you ever do. And you can't spend money while you're doing it. Not easily, anyway. I guess you could open your Amazon app because you decided, I wish I had this thing and buy it. But I find the more low-cost hobbies we have, the less reckless spending we do. And when you start, like, you pick up a boat and you start lake fishing and all, you always find, like, another thing that you need that you don't really need, but you convince yourself you need it. Or you're off doing some other shit that involves spending money, like going out to eat or something. When you have low-cost hobbies, you spend less money. And this is about as low-cost as a hobby can get, because I could literally take, you know, if I had a kid as about as big as this little case right here, it's more than I would ever need plus one fishing rod. I will talk about some gear stuff today and maybe something beyond that, but you don't need it. And that's, I think that's really cool. Now I want to talk a little bit about how to find locations. The easiest way is you don't want to find locations that are very far away from you, because then you won't go often. And if you're going to go far, you might as well, you know, at least potentially look at larger bodies of water and things like that. There's a lot of places. I'm going to show you a couple of them that I used to do this down in Arlington. Now, Arlington is about 45 minutes to an hour, depending on traffic, for where I live now. And I don't go really down there much anymore, even though there's some really cool places, because it's far. And so I found really cool places much closer to home, so I can do it more often, or at least whenever I want to. So the best thing to do is just keep your eyes open. Whenever you're, that's good for situational awareness, like we talked about originally. Anyway, you know, drive around and look. Maybe someday just take a drive to, you know, with like make a 10-mile radius around your house. Just drive around places you've never been before. Any place there's a lake, like a reservoir or major lake, there's creeks flowing into it and out of it. Find places where they cross the road. Look for parked cars where other people are fishing. This will often help you find better spots than that spot. People like to fish spots where it's big water, right? So even in a creek, they're looking for where it's really deep, and it might be a good spot. If you see people fishing there all the time, there's a very good chance that it is. It also might just be a place where a bunch of people drown worms and sit around drinking beer and don't catch much and talk shit with each other, you know? But then often, if you start, well, where does that creek come from and where does it go? And if you start heading more toward the headwaters where you get smaller bodies of water, the holes will concentrate more fish because there's less to work with up there. So you can find the place where all the bubbas fish and then track back to the direction that water's coming from. And you can often find places that are ignored and better, even though you started out with a bubba spot. Okay. Most bridges are there for a reason. If you drive down a road somewhere and you go over and over past, look, no matter how little water's in there, there's probably something. Now we can begin a journey of discovery and figure out what else is there. I'm telling you, I have found places. I don't even know how the fish got in it. There's a place in Arlington. I couldn't find it on the map when I pulled it up for that part of the podcast, but it was down toward where my sister-in-law lived, and it looked like a puddle on two sides of the road with a culvert connecting it. There must be a creek that comes off of one of the many creeks down there around Joel Pool Lake that flows into it at some point during the year. But in the summer, when I tried fishing it, there was no way any water was getting in there. And you could look at that water and go, maybe not this year, in a wet year, but in a dry year, this thing's going to dry up. There's going to be nothing left. And unless you've got mud skippers or something hiding in the mud, everything in it's going to die. So and there was tons of little fish in it, little bluegills. In the South, we call them perch. They're not perch, right? We know they're not perch. You can relax, you people. It's really two species, a white perch and yellow perch, and that's a bluegill. In the fucking South, they call it a perch. In the Southeast, they call it a fucking brim. Just let it go. Don't go there. I'm not going to say that again today. So if I use perch that way or something you're not familiar with, just get the fuck over it. But, you know, you are – if you start taking and following those places that you locate, you'll find places like that, and they can be really good, because what they usually are, again, is you get some sort of flowing, moving, or larger body of water that backs up into them, and then when the dry season comes, anybody that doesn't get back out gets stranded, and stranded fish are kind of like fish in a barrel. And this place was, I want to say the actual surface area of the water was like on both sides of the road, and they were both about the size of my office. And when we were fishing there, people were like slowing down and looking like, what is wrong with these people? And we literally could not throw a line in and not catch a fish. Now, they were all little as shit, but if you're stocking your own stock tanks or backyard ponds or something, or you're getting bait, because that's another great use of this skill. So one of my target species is bullheads. I don't do a lot of flathead fishing, but every flathead fisherman I knows the bullhead catfish is probably the best flathead bait you can get, because flatheads love them, and they live for days on like a limb line or something like that. So let's keep going. Google Maps for pre-scouting. I've got some screens pulled up here that I'm going to show you some things. Some actually really close to my house. And so those of you on the audio only will have to follow me as best you can with what I'm explaining here. And this might be worth pulling up the video. And if you want to do that and you're listening to the audio, you can make a note somewhere right around 26 minutes. If you jump about 26 minutes in the video, you'll be able to see this. Let's go ahead. And this is near where I live. I don't want to show you exactly where I live. And I did pre-game this one, and, this is not a spot I fish, but I have fished this creek, and I probably will check this spot out. But all I'm doing when I do this, let me come out some. This is exactly what I'm talking about. If you look here, this lake is known as Eagle Mountain Lake. This is a beautiful lake. It's a clean lake. It has no consumption advisory, so creeks in and out are probably fine. Now, just south of it is Lake Worth. And that is borders Lockheed, and they ruined it back in the 60s for multiple human lifetimes. It's got PCBs in it. So, again, knowing your area is helpful. So the reason I bring that up is I might show something in Atlanta or something. You're like, you'll die and your dick will fall off if you fish there. Guys, you got to have some local knowledge. But anyway, I'm looking. I know this is clean water. I know this is a good lake. And I know anywhere there's a lake, there's going to be streams. And I'm in the map view. For those of you that are on the audio again. So I'm in the plain old map view, and I'm just looking for blue lines that look like blue roads. And you can see I've got them all over the place here, up near Springtown and back through here. And when I look at that, what I want to start doing is I'll start zooming in. And I'll look. In this case, I actually know a little bit about this creek. And I'm going to look for any place that it crosses a road. And so I've already found that. So now I'm looking at this place where it crosses a road, and I'm going to switch when I get zoomed in so I know I can find it. Because a lot of times these creeks, they're dry creeks during the summer, and if that's when the satellite image was taken, there ain't going to be nothing there. It'd be very hard to figure out exactly where they were, or is that really a creek or whatever. But in this case, as I zoom in, I can see I've got a pretty big overpass, and I've got visible water on both sides of the road. Right away, given I know the area, I know the water is limestone spring fed, I know there's not that much agriculture in the area, there's no industry in the area, and the lake that it's dumping into is clean. I want to check this out from a pollution and from a just tactical standpoint. I can look here at this, and what I can see is I probably can get away with parking somewhere over here. This looks like some kind of sand quarry or something that's going on here. This also could have been a drilling platform, so that could be an issue if you're worried about pollution. But if it was, it is long, long gone, and this water is constantly flowing through. That's one thing I really like about creeks. As I get down closer, I can see that I've got skinny water coming into a big hole underneath the creek, going back to skinny water, making another hole. These are all places I would want to check out. So this would be a place that I probably wouldn't, unless I was just driving around fishing. I wouldn't, like, I'm fishing and I'm going here. I would, you know, this is only 15 minutes from my house. I would mark this, make a note. Next time I'm out and about and I've got a few minutes to kill, I would drive by and check this out. More on checking places out in a minute. Here's another place. Let me check back and make sure I'm not messing nothing up. Okay. Yep. Jack was right. One third of all people here versus the people who came to Doom and Gloom AI yesterday. Absolutely. It always is that way. But this next one, this is near a place called White Settlement. And this is a place that I still fish. I'm not worried 300 TSPers are going to show up and start fishing this place because I give it to you. And this is a really easy one to find because it is a city park. And this is not a creek or a ditch, but it's what we would call ditch fishing. It's small enough water that serious fishermen would generally mock you. That's another way to look at ditch fishing. Well, I used to do this a lot. I also used to fish with a professional guide out on Joe Pool Lake named Hal Bodd. And we would take trips to like Texoma, Tawakoni, et cetera, sometimes trips down to the coast. And when he would see me talking about this on social media, he'd be like, hey, make sure you pick up my marker buoy for me when it'd be like a little city pond or something. And he'd mock it, but it was because he didn't understand it. He didn't get reconnecting with being a kid, unfortunately. But this, see this here, green? Whenever you see green, that's probably a public space. That's a park. That's called Central Park. But it's in White Settlement, Texas, not New York City. And all of a sudden, I see a lake. Well, when I switch down to this view, I can look right here. I see baseball fields. I know I can park. I got a parking lot right here, which is right where I park. And honestly, right where you see that arrow, I've fished right there in that spot many times and then right down here in that spot. This is just a pretty basic, fairly shallow lake. It's only about 4 foot deep at the deepest. You can see that this here is where it overflows. It looks like a creek coming into it. It might be a blue line on the map, but I can tell you right now it's dry most of the year. And you can see it's dry right there in that ditch. But look at that, a little bit of water in there. Now, I know something from local intelligence talking to kids. Talk to kids. Kids know shit. Kids on bikes, they still exist. It ain't like the 80s when they all were, but some of them still travel around these neighborhoods. And I know that when there's heavy rains in the spring and that weir overflows, fish go down in that ditch, they get stranded in it and they die. And that means in the spring, that's a good place to go collect fish, that if you don't do it, they're going to die. I mean, they're absolutely 100% going to die. If I switch back to this view and I start zooming out, though, look, I've got another creek. Now, right up here, I can pull up. This is Judd Street. And I can take a look at that and go, that's a place I'd check out as well. Little skinny water. Look at this big hole back here. That's a place I want to check out. But let's do something totally different. Let's put Jack back on his heels. It's not fair for me to go like right around my house and do this because maybe I can't tell by the map alone. So now I'm in Nashville. I know nothing about Nashville. I've been to Nashville like one time on a vacation. And I've driven through there on, you know, 40, 440, around 40 back down a bunch of times, but I've never spent any time in there. I'm going to go south of Nashville, and I'm going to start zooming in. I'm going to start looking for water. Okay. And I'm going to be looking for something similar to what I've already found. Okay, I already found a creek. This creek runs here. Now, I might do more if I was serious about this, but I want to just find something as quick as I can. So now I found this place called Harding Pike. So that's probably a pretty big road. It might be too big to be effectively fished. It might be just perfect. I've also got a branch where this splits into two creeks, which means it's probably flowing north. It's not definite, but it's probably flowing north because these two come together. It could be south, and this could be a tributary that comes off it. I don't know because I don't know the area. But when I switch over here, now I can start zooming in. I don't know what that has a Dunkin' Donuts there. It means I can park. And look at that. Doesn't it look a lot like what I just showed you for those that can see it? There's a deep hole right there. There's that Highway 70. That's probably what was labeled a pike. And this is where it makes sense to switch back to your map. I'm going to pull out. And I'm right here, actually, this looks like a place I would more likely want to check out. And that looks like a beautiful spot. Okay, if I'm in Nashville, especially on the southwest side of Nashville, I'm checking this spot out. Now, somebody might live there and be like, Jack, everybody knows about that spot. Well, that would even be cooler, wouldn't it? If it's a spot that everybody knows about and I know nothing, I know absolutely nothing about the area, and I found that spot in just a few, less than a few minutes, I'm going to tell you that you can too. Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia. I also know nothing. And I mean, I know the square root of nothing about Atlanta, Georgia. So I'm going to zoom in. I've got a major highway 85, which I also know nothing about here. I'm going to go up on like kind of the upper northeastern loop. I'm going to start zooming in. I'm looking for ponds and lakes and streams. Right here, I've got a Costco, and I've got a city pond of some kind or some sort of green area. And that green area extends up here. Okay, so I've got parks, and I've got a stream. Now, this would also probably have more people. And when I zoom in without the map, when I go to satellite view, it's very hard to see that stream. I can't tell much about it, but it would probably be worth checking out. It looks like there's a stream that comes right through there. You got an overpass right there. It also looks like a very kind of upper crusty rich people area, which can be good because you're less likely to get jacked by some hobo underneath the bridge. By the way, if you are an armed citizen, and you should be whenever you're doing this, bring your gun with you. I won't bring it up today on screen, but I will tell you that I recently watched a video of a dude almost get jacked by two dudes fishing like this in Houston. Two dudes kind of roll up on him, start asking him about his shoes, get up in his face, and as soon as that gun comes out, they're gone. I'll see if I can find it. But over here by this Costco, so this stream runs into that same part for those on the audio. Let me find that again. See how that kind of disappeared on me right there when I don't know exactly where to look for it? So here's where the stream is. So now I'm coming into this stream, and look at that. I've got white water. So I've probably got water flowing toward that lake, not out of it, because that'd be to the south. And I've got kind of little rapids right here, and then this is completely grown in, and I've got a fairly large road. And if I go back, look at that. That looks like an apartment complex or office park. That looks like some kind of apartments where people park in the interior. There's a track and field thing. There's a Costco, like I said. Okay, so I've got a place to park. I've got a place to park to check this out. I got a little bit of a walk from the Costco parking lot, but at least I've got that. It looks like I've got an apartment complex here. And unless it's a gated complex, that could be. So I'm always looking for parking too. This would be worth checking out. I wouldn't get super excited about this, but it would definitely be worth checking out. Let's go back to places that I know because I found them this way. But this is an area I used to fish a lot, and it will show you what to look for because I know what to look for here. So this is a place called Cravens Park in Arlington. I used to fish there a lot. And what I'm looking for is where it crosses Collins Avenue. And right here. Okay, look at this. This is beautiful, right? So now I've got a paved path that goes through here that follows the creek. And there's the creek with an overflow on both ends. That, I can tell you right there, that's a fantastic spot. We've caught tons of fish there and up and down creek from there. Let me back off this a bit. There's a very old video of me, and if you want to find it, you can search for survival fishing with flowers. And I'm going to show you where that spot is, where I caught all those fish in that video. So there's a bunch of baseball fields here. It's a public park, plenty of parking. A little pond here. We've caught a lot of fish, including channel cats that were put in that pond. But this trail and this creek goes right through it. I know this is kind of hard. Right, see how it gets close to the trail right here? Right in this big bend right here, we've caught tons of fish, and then back up here we've caught tons of fish of various different types. So I know that's, if you're on the audio, that might have been a little bit like, what is he talking about? Again, 26 to 36 minutes of video, so 26 minutes in to 36 minutes in, you'll find most of that, and hopefully that will be helpful to you. And hopefully when I'm doing the other stuff that I'm going to be doing today, using the video, that it will not be as confusing. I realize that's confusing, again, to the people on audio, but I thought it was important enough to go ahead and show the people on the video. It's just a simple matter of let's find bodies of water that look promising, let's trace them, and let's figure out how we would get there, where we would park, and what they look like, and then let's go by and check them out. When you do check locations, there's some of the things you can look for. And this will reinforce the whole pollution thing. there's a lot of places that people will check out like this, and they'll think this is really a kind of a polluted place. But what they're really looking at is human garbage where humans sit and fish, or humans sit and drink beer, or humans sit and hang out. It doesn't mean the water is bad in of itself. I mean, there's other things to check, obviously. But that also can give you a lot of information. If you see people left behind fishing line, hooks, packages, bait containers, Y sticks, so somebody's made a little rod holder stick and left it behind, little fire rings and stuff, people fish there. If people fish there, there's probably fish in the location. And again, a lot of times these, I call them Bubba spots, right? The Bubba spot may not be the best spot. That one location I showed you down in Arlington, we had kids on bicycles, people walking, hiking, running, jogging, rollerblading, all of that shit straight past us. Almost nobody fished all of that spot along that creek. It was hard to get into some spots. There were only certain spots you actually could fish without like fighting the trees and whatever. And, yep, that's the one, Tom. On YouTube, search for Approached While Fishing Houston, Texas. That is the one. If you look that up, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Stay armed in these situations. There are places, good time for a disclaimer. Thanks for that, Tom. There are some of these places that when I said hobos, I'm not kidding. They're like modern hobos, right? Or more like modern tramps than hobos, if you know the difference. And they kind of will get territorial and see it's like their spot. And I'm not talking about Bubba's with fishing. I'm talking like homeless people that live under an overpass and shit. And those people can be dangerous. And if you look up that video, dude like scares those two guys away and goes back to fishing, I would have probably went and found another place. Right? And you could be like, well, Jack, are you just going to let people bully you or whatever? I'm not going to do stupid places and do stupid things in stupid places with stupid people. And those two dudes, if you look up the video, you see what I'm talking about. They kind of look a little ganged up. And they might be going back to get, and he kind of goes back to fishing after that. Like, just be aware that that is a potential risk. And that's why I like to, I say urban, but I like to get a little further out because the Bubba fisherman is usually not a problem. He's usually a guy who'll tell you some stuff and you can hang out and drink a beer with him. All right. So the bigger thing to do though is just look for fish. These are small bodies of water. A lot of times the water is really clear, especially this time of year. The spring and the fall, a lot of places you think, man, this is mucky, muddy water. All it is runoff. All it is mud that got washed in by the rains. You go at a time of year where the water's a little thinner, a little shallower, and moving a little slower, and everything's had time to settle out, crystal clear water. If you look in a place like that and you check a few fishy looking spots and you don't see any fish, I'm not saying there's no fish there. I'm saying there might not be much worth fishing there for. Not because you can't catch anything, but because I bet you within 10, 15 minutes of the area, you can find a place that you do see fish. There's a place that I'm going to be going later this week. I just checked it out. I fished both sides of it. I've never tried this particular area before. I worked my way down. It's pretty steep bank and all, but once you're down, there's plenty of places to sit. The overpass is perfect shade, and there are fish everywhere. I'm not saying they're huge or anything, but there's fish in there. Like, just standing on the bridge looking down, I saw four bullhead catfish. You never see bullheads. They like to hide. Why can you see them? Because the water's thin, the water's clear, and they're hungry, and they're out looking for food. Which is another reason this gets really, really easy. John Rayborn says, stop and talk to the hobos. Yes, just be careful. I agree. The kind of people I'm talking about, I really wouldn't call hobos. Okay? I'm just saying there could be some problems there. My buddy David, who I mentioned from time to time, there was an overpass like this on I-20 in a creek that comes out of Lake Arlington. And he used to call them his pet hobos. He used to go down there and teach them how to do stuff that they didn't know how to do. He tried to buy them some cheap fishing rods. They didn't want them. They wanted to do hand lines and stuff. They didn't want. And so you can get along with great, really get along great with people. Just be careful. That's all I'm saying. I'm not putting anybody out because of their place in life or their choice in life. Just what they might choose to do to you. But if you see fish, you're going to catch fish. Whatever you see, there's 100 times more. In this particular spot, I actually had checked it out before. I just never fished it. That creek that I showed you stopped running last year. It hasn't stopped running this year. Last year, the drought was so bad, it stopped running. My veterinarian said he had never seen that creek not run. He's like 85 years old, and he's lived here his whole life. All right. And also look for water that skinny, whole, skinny again. When I say skinny, I mean shallow. I mean, it can't really hold fish well. And what you'll find in these creeks, and this is why this time of year is a really great time, you have less rain, the water's clear, you can identify things, but fish concentrate. And when fish concentrate, they get hungry because there's more competition for food. So you know how sometimes, like, you'll be at a place and you visually spot a fish, and you drop that lure or that bait right where you want to, not on top so it doesn't spook him. You move it toward him a little bit. He starts checking it out, and you let it settle to the, you know, let it drop or do anything that should trigger a predator response. And he kind of just swims up to it like, no, I don't think so. Like, something about that presentation just wasn't right. Maybe that fish has been caught a few times. And he's like, not today, Satan. No way. I ain't doing it. They don't have time for that shit. When you have a couple hundred fish in a hole that's like 100 foot long and 10 foot wide, and everybody's fighting for everything, you put a bait in front of that fish, in general, they're going to hit it. And if one doesn't, the other one's going to. That's one of the things I love about this type of fishing. On that, what are the most common target species in the U.S.? And I want to also pause here and say, yes, get a fishing license to do this. I am not advocating for the state. I don't think you should need a license for this kind of fishing. I honestly think that fish wardens and shit should leave people the F alone that are fishing in ditches under roads or tiny little park ponds or all these little pocket waters like this. There is no game fish management to be done in these at any meaningful level. But I have been checked by a warden very few times fishing. I think I've been out with a guide once, with my uncle once, when we were on a lake in a boat, and, you know, show us your flotation devices and shit like that. Where's your fishing license? I've gotten one ticket in my life fishing exactly this way. Exactly. I didn't have a license. I went home to Pennsylvania from the Army. I'd literally been out of the Army 2 days. A buddy of mine wanted to go fishing. It was the middle of summer. We're out in farm country, PA. We're fishing a muddy creek that's never stocked. The only thing in it is like freaking suckers and chubs. Fish warden came, gave me a ticket. I told him I've been out of the Army 2 days. He didn't believe me. I had my discharge shit in my trunk. Showed it to him. You know why? They're bored. If they're out driving around checking people like that in the summertime, they're bored and they need some freaking citations to prove they're doing their job. So I, you know, a fishing license for a year in Texas, all water is like $50. A ticket's like $300. Plus, they can cause you more trouble. So I'm just going to throw that out there. I definitely need to advise you on that. What are my most targeted species, though? Around here, again, somebody mentioned, like, we don't need any autistic shrieking about the names of fish, but it's brim or perch or sunfish. That's number one. And when we get into the right names, we're talking bluegills. We're talking pumpkin seeds. We're talking redbreast. We're talking long ears. We're talking green sunfish. What do you call them? Red ears, shell crackers. All of these various varieties. And a lot of times, some of these fish will hybridize with each other. And so you'll catch, like, I can't remember what they call them now, but they're like half bluegill, half green sunfish mixed together, things like that. We catch a ton of stuff like that. Some really pretty little different sunfish. And, you know, the beauty of them is they eat whatever the hell's in front of them. And it's amazing sometimes, these little bodies of water, you catch these little fish and they're not very big, but you know they ain't starving. They're thick little suckers, man. One of the things about the flowing water, like, I do include city parks and stuff like this, little ponds and all in this. But when you have water moving through, there's more food there than you think there is. There's tons of minnows, dragonfly larvae, all kinds of stuff these fish are eating, crustaceans, little crawfish and things like that. But that's the number one that you definitely see the most of, catch the most of, even when you're not targeting. Black bass, largemouth, smallmouth, red eye, so all the different little subspecies of bass. They're in there. They're usually not very big, but, like, this place that I'm going to try later this week, under the road, I saw a largemouth in there. That thing had to be a good 16-inch fish. Now, that's not huge. I've caught a lot of bass bigger than that. Well, for a little tiny creek, that dude is hanging out in that hole, and he's eating whatever bluegill is dumb enough to get too close to him. And so that might tell you how I might go about targeting him for catching. But we do have a lot of bass in these types of waters. And a lot of them, what you end up with is a ton of bass, and they seem to kind of top out around 10 inches. You might see one big one. But they're in there, and they're fun to catch. You also have catfish. And a lot of these little creeks in the south, if there's some big holes in even a small creek, you might find some really big flatheads in those holes. And if you happen to hook up with them and the kind of rods that you know you use for fishing like this, you're probably not landing it. Those are big fish. But the number one catfish species you'll find in these little creeks and ponds and stuff is going to be bullhead cats. They are one of my favorite fish in the world. There's a lot of Malang speak about them. There's actually a whole episode on fishing for bullheads at thesurvivalpodcast.com. It's before I was doing video, though, so it's audio only. But to me, they are one of the most misunderstood, most maligned, excellent little fish there is. A lot of people hate them because they steal bait. Not all fish steal bait when they're small. A lot of people don't like them because they'll stab you. All catfish will stab you. A lot of people don't like them because they think they eat mud or they eat their own poop or whatever they made up. You can't live that way. It would be like trying to run your car and recycle the exhaust back in the motor. And you can actually do that once, and then it'll sort of run, and then it'll die when it runs out of fuel. You can't live on your own excrement, even though it's disgusting and no one would try it. They don't do it either. I've kept these fish in fish tanks, like I have sitting right behind the camera right now. I have like six fish tanks just in my office. I've kept bullheads in there. I've never seen them eat another fish's poop. You know what they like to eat? Minnows and goldfish. They're predators. They're predators, but they get misunderstood because they're ambush predators. And what I mean by that is they don't, I mean, I've caught them on beetle spins and lures and stuff. So don't tell me they won't go out and attack. But generally what they do is they sit in a place and they act as an ambush predator. When you keep them in a fish tank, that place I showed you in Arlington that I used to fish, that little creek and that little pond, I brought home like 10 of them and threw them in a 55-gallon fish tank with some little rock caves and stuff, and they'd all sit in there. And I fed them, I caught them to eat fish food. These were little. I mean, these were like 3-4 inch bullheads. And I just taught them to eat fish food because if they don't eat long enough, they'll eat anything. And then about once every 2 weeks, I'd go down to that pond and throw a couple bits of bread in there and just take a dip in it. I'd bring home 200-300 minnows, little Grambrosia mosquito fish. I'd throw them in there, and it was a slaughter. It was a slaughter, and they are so quick. You think of them like just this little mud cat, whatever. When they're sitting there and that minnow comes by that mouth, it will put a bass to shame, the inhale snap, and you literally hear it out on the outside of the tank. You can hear like a thump. And they just, and if you look up feeding bullheads or something like that on YouTube, you'll find all kinds of people that have done this. They are predatory as all get out. They also can smell and sense with their whiskers and their entire outer body. So they feel like sharks do, like they have a lateral line, just like bass do, that they can hear vibration and stuff like that, but they can literally taste through their skin. So that's why shrimp and stink baits and hot dogs and all work for them. They'll take what they can get. But here's my thing when people say bullheads are nothing but scavengers. What are they scavenging on? What are they scavenging? You go to this little pond, and there's 800,000 million bullheads in it. What are they scavenging? How much, if you took and put on a scuba mask and a snorkel, and swim around, how much do you think you're going to look on the bottom and see dead shit laying everywhere? What do you think they're eating? There's not enough things laying dead, and they don't like anything that lies dead on the bottom gets eaten quick. If anything, will eat it. There's just no way to do that. They are predatory, so they're a great little fish. Chubs and carp show up here and there. Chubs are pretty much, there's some kind of chub in almost every creek. They're a great cut bait, by the way. Carp are there because they've ended up there getting in from lakes or people letting them go or something like that. Lots of stuff being mentioned here by Victory Garden. It's the Gambrosia, which are the little mosquito fish. Grass shrimp and algae, chara algae, make bass ponds explode. Because you're building the a food chain is what you're doing from the bottom up when you do that. Meaning that the largemouth bass isn't going to eat a lot of Gambrusia because they're so little. They're just not worth the effort. They'll take them here and there, but they generally want, but that Gambrusia is fed upon by like bluegill that breed, and the little bluegill, that's largemouth candy, right? But in the deep south, you get South Texas, South Florida, you get some invasives and some native, like down South Texas, you get these Rio Grande cichlids, which are a native fish down there. But in Florida, there's a lot of these dishes and stuff are full of like exotic cichlids, stuff that people go to the pet store to buy. And those are really cool to catch. And some of them are pretty good eating too. And honestly, you just never know. I've caught pickerel. I've caught gar. I've caught crappie, buffalo, drum. I've caught American eel. You just don't know. And that's kind of the fun of it. You never know what's going to turn up. And again, I want to say real quick on this, I'm only talking about this for a couple minutes. But backyard aquaculture, this is a great case for that. So for those that don't know me, I have several above ground ponds in my backyard because I can't dig a hole here. I would have a couple half acre ponds on my property if I could dig a hole, but I can't. It's all rock. It's all limestone. And so I have one that's about 4,500 gallons. I have another system. The whole system's about 3,000 gallons, but the main pond in it is like a long rectangle pond. It's pretty shallow, actually, about 18 inches at the deepest, but it's holding about, I would say, almost 3,000 gallons of water. I've got several systems like this, and they're all running on pumps to keep the fish alive. But, you know, I've had some of these, I've gone out to these little places and brought home, and when I do this, I always try to select fish in a given size range because they will cannibalize each other, right? Especially bullheads will eat each other. I promise you, I've seen them do it. But I might take this one pond and say this year I'm going to put 100 in there that are all between 4 and 5 inches. And I've thrown them in there. And by the, you know, like the next spring going into summer, you've got bullheads swimming around in there that are 14, 16 inch fish that are pellet trained and they come to the surface and eat. Again, that fish is going to be as clean as any fish you're ever going to buy in a store. Some of y'all worried about not pollution. You're buying freaking fish out of Thailand and in freaking China that are pretty much fed on like human waste and shit like that. I don't know, man. I feel a little more comfortable eating the fish in my backyard. But this is a great case for backyard aquaculture. You know, my favorite bluegills are just a little too small to keep. Not legally. I mean, just for me. Like, I would be like, I don't really want to clean that fish. That fish is like, you know, a 7-inch bluegill and up. Those are full hand sized. You know, makes nice little fillets or whatever off of them. You catch them 4 and 5 inches, that fish only has to grow for, and when you're feeding it, another 2 or 3 months. You grow him for a year, and he's a big old fatty and one of the best eating fish you'll get your hands on. So just want to say that in addition to all this, backyard aquaculture is worth considering. Those of you that have a big enough, you know, you have some stock tanks and stuff like that, stock the shit out of them and feed them. And that way you know what you're eating because you're controlling it. Just getting your stocking for free and giving them enough time to clean out is what I'm saying. All right. So what is the gear that you need? Again, I think a basic pocket kit. When I was a kid growing up in Florida, we always had little pocket kits on us. And they were, I mean, they sold them in fishing stores and stuff like that. Until we don't need to buy this. We can make it ourselves. And it was usually just a piece of wood with, you know, 20, 30, 40 foot of line on it with a hook and a weight and a bobber. And you could easily throw that in your pocket. You have a few extra hooks and what have you. And then we real quick figured out there's like aluminum cans everywhere. And you could take that line and wrap it around that can and basically make a hand reel out of it. Or you can cut down a limb and make a cane pole. We used to do that kind of stuff all the time. But I would go beyond that. But, you know, keeping something like that in your car, you can always check something and come back later with the rest of your gear. It'd be one of the things you could do. I like to take with me 1 to 2 light action rods. I almost always take 2, even if I'm only going to fish with one. If something really like gets really jacked up with that rod, I might only be fishing for an hour, hour and a half like this. That's one of the beautiful things about it. I don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and spend all day out on the lake or whatever. I can just jet off at the end of the day. You know, sometimes I drop my grandkids off with their mom and it'll be, you know, 5:30 when she picks them up. And I'll hit one of these spots on the way home for 30, 40 minutes. So in that situation, if something goes wrong with one of my rods, I throw it to the side, pick the other rod up. So two is one, one is none. Sometimes I'll even take three rods because there are situations where I'll be like, there's a really deep hole there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play with these little fish. I'm going to catch me a little fish and put his whole ass or a big old hunk of cut bait on and take this other rod that's a little heavier. I'm going to drop it in that hole and just see what's here because you never know. I like to have some lures, especially like small jigs and spinners and tube baits. In this type of fishing, not overall, but in this type of fishing, I am really a fan of bait that I'll get to in a second. But the beauty of lures is lures catch fish, and fish are bait for other fish. And lures don't need to be refrigerated, right? So and I've seen places where, you know, you're fishing with bait and you're not catching much, but you put a little tube jig on or something and you can't keep them off the line. So having that flexibility is good. But small jigs, spinners, tube baits, et cetera, like little mini gitsets and stuff, you know, you don't need to be throwing a big crankbait that dives to a D22 in 2 foot of water. It ain't going to work. Or heavy spoons or slabs and all generally don't work well in this. What's nice about little jigs is a lot of the places we're talking about, your conventional cast and retrieve doesn't work really well. You can kind of pitch back into a spot, and with a jig, you can kind of hop it along or twitch it, and that'll often trigger a strike where you really can't get something that's more of like what you think of fishing with in a lake or what have you, where you're casting and retrieving with heavier equipment. Now, the reason that I like bait is when you find a spot like that, and if you can get back into there, you can just leave it the hell there and something will come along and hit it sooner or later. My favorite baits for this, again, I'm back to this type of fishing, these small water fishing, salted shrimp, which I'll talk about in a second. I have a whole video on that. Worms, corn, any of the Berkeley Gulp products work really good because you can just throw them in a kit and always have it and have something to start out with. Because, again, if you can catch a couple bluegills and you got a knife, you got more bait. And you can just keep going from there. But I also like grasshoppers and crickets, especially if they just happen to be around. Like I've been out fishing before and, ooh, there's a rock, turn it over, and there's five crickets under there. Throw them in a cup or something, and you got great bait to start out with. Grasshoppers, man, when I was a kid, I would just go out and just get a jar with some holes poked in the lid, and I could catch 50 grasshoppers in 5 minutes. And they were one of the best baits for this kind of fishing, especially up there was trout. And so you take a little small hook, like a number 12, go through the back underneath the wings of a grasshopper. He'll float. And you float his ass where trout are, they're going to slam his ass. Here, I don't really have grasshoppers much anymore because the freaking ducks eat them all, which is a good thing. Minnows, which I always try to take like a dip net or something like that, and cut bait. Like those are the main things that I do. The salted shrimp, because I like to target bullheads, is one of the best baits I've ever found. To make it, you don't need expensive shrimp. Go to Walmart. You can buy a bag of frozen shrimp there, tail on, shelled, for $4 or $5. It'll be like a 12-ounce bag or something like that. Throw it in a Tupperware dish, cover it with the cheapest ass, like kosher salt you can get your hands on until it gets hard. You'll get a bunch of water out of it. Dump that water out. Take the fish out of the salt or the shrimp out of the salt. Kind of leave a little bit on, but basically clear it off with your hands. Put that in a Ziploc bag. Throw it in the refrigerator. You can then take that out all day fishing with it, and it won't go bad. It won't get really stinky. It won't become useless, and you can bring it back home, and you can use it over and over again. I've caught, I think one day I was wanting to see how many bullheads I could catch on one piece, not one shrimp, one piece of one salted shrimp. I caught nine before the freaking one. The last one I caught swallowed the hook down to his gut. Probably if I'd have ripped it out, I probably could have caught 10. Where I've used shrimp pieces of fresh shrimp, and a lot of times with bullheads and other small fish, you get like one peck or peck, and it's gone. You're like, where's the next bite? And you reel it in, it's gone. They can't steal it. It gets too hard, and I have not had any drop-off in hits on that salted shrimp. I'm not saying you can salt all bait. I'm telling you it works beautifully for bullheads and perch, brim, sunfish, call them what you want to, with shrimp cut up like that. And it's one of my favorite overall baits. I also like chumming these spots, especially if you're going to be targeting catfish. Best way I know to chum catfish, and it'll chum a lot of bait fish, which chums other fish as well, get a can of cheap cat food, get an old school can opener, not for like open the can of beans can opener. Like if you're old like me, you remember things like Hi-C that came in a big giant can, and it was like a church key, but on one side it opened bottles, on the other side it made a hole, made a little triangular hole, and you made a little hole on one side, a big hole on the other, you could pour your Hi-C, right? Okay, you take one of those, they still make them, they're still around, you take a can of cat food, and you make a bunch of holes, just little holes with it. The tab that you pull to open the can, pull the tab up, but don't open the can. Tie a string to it and put it where you want it for chum. And that way you're not an asshole and you're not polluting the place. And when you leave, pull it out, dump it out in the water, let the fish have it, rinse out the can, take it home, throw it away. I said look for trash and all. My rule is I don't go out and pretend to be on community service and completely clean an area. But every time I fish a place, if there's trash there, I take two or three things and throw them in a bag and get rid of it. And if everybody did that, we'd solve the problem pretty quick. But that is a great way to chum. It's also a great way to pre-chum. So, like, if this is close to home, and it should be, you can take if you're going to be able to fish this evening and you're out this morning, like, say you're going to work, you're going to come home, and then you're going to fish, or you're going to fish on the way home from work, take that can, throw that in that hole on the way to work, and watch what happens by the time you show up in the evening to fish there. And this is another reason I really like overpasses. It's always shaded. More on that in just a bit. You also need, obviously, hooks and weights of various sizes. I like to have smaller than I think I need and bigger than I think I need on both. On weights, I really like, I don't even know what they're called. The one, like Water Gremlin makes them. They have a little piece of rubber in them, and the line just slides into them. They're really easy to take on and off and slide up and down a line. And I like those, and I like split shots. And with split shots, I like the ones that have ears, the ones that are removable. My uncle and my grandfather, my great uncles and all, they always used to refer to the split shots that didn't have ears as communist, right? Because you can't get them back off the damn line if you decide you want to go weightless. They're marketed as snagless, and maybe they snag a little less, but not that much. I don't like communist ones either. That is a really great way to go. Somebody said I never get skunked with night crawlers. I said worms in there. Let's talk a little bit about that. There's another reason to have a worm farm, isn't it? Now, for a lot of this kind of fishing, the red worms that we use for compost worms work really well, but you can have a worm farm that's mixed with night crawlers and red worms, or you can have, you know, a worm farm for your composting. It's red worms and one is night crawlers. And that way you always have worms available, and they absolutely work great as well. Especially night crawlers in these situations are deadly on bass, black bass. And the best results I've had is you want a good size but not giant night crawler, big thick collar on them, no weight, you know, an eagle claw hook, like a bait holder, and just hook them just through the collar, just through the collar. And then cast past where, if you know where that fish is, you cast past him and bring it back towards him. And as soon as he looks at it, just stop and just let that thing float to the bottom. It will usually, like, again, these situations, these fish can't afford to be picky. And even just a few times of doing that, and even the one that's a little bit line shy, you'll usually get him. I've been out with friends who are like, I can't catch that bass. Give me 5 minutes and that bass is flipping on the bank. Yeah. Because it's just that easy with them. If you're keeping fish, I want to say another thing is I like small circle hooks. I'll see if I can look that up and add it to the show notes for you. I like these little circle hooks. The problem with small circle hooks, they still have a pretty significant gap in them, but I found some pretty good ones that were generally made with like bluegill sunfish in mind. And they work really great for bullheads because bullheads have a real tendency. They call them bullheads because like half the fish is head, right? And so they will just engulf things. And so if you have that circle hook and you're staying with a tight line, they'll usually hook themselves really, really easily. Another thing that works really good and has a lot of different uses is jig heads. And small jig heads, especially with like an Aberdeen long shank style hook, great for bullheads because something about it, when they grab it and they get up to that head, they'll still hold on to it so you can hook them, but they don't want to swallow that for some reason. And I get a lot more hookups without it being down the gullet. If you have a bullhead that's down the gullet and you want to give it a chance to live, the best thing to do is cut the line and throw it back in the water. If you pull it out, it ain't going to happen. If you're keeping fish, then I recommend that you take, especially if you want to bring them somewhere else because you're taking them for bait when you talk to the rabbit sheriff, if you catch my drift. You want something that allows them to stay in the water, a minnow bucket, a collapsible fabric laundry basket, a metal collapsible fish basket, something like that. They don't take up any space. They stay in the water. And if you're going to use, like, I use a battery-powered, use 2D batteries air pump. It'll run for like 48 hours on two batteries. I take those things to Florida when I go fishing to keep shrimp and bait alive. I take them when I go do this. If I'm going to go on a long trip, like I'm going to be gone for all day and I'm really doing a big stocking, then I take my truck. I put a 100-gallon igloo cooler in the back of the truck. I run a, an inverter. I fill it up with water before I leave for my own ponds because that's if they don't make it, they don't make it. Whatever, most of them are going to live anyway. I take a small pond pump with a piece of PVC pipe and make like an overflow, like a waterfall in a live bait box, a fish box in a bass boat, like that. And I'll just have that running even before fish are in there so that water's nice and cool and ready to go. Otherwise, I take like a 5-gallon bucket with a lid, with a hole in the lid, and I keep the fish in a some sort of basket until I'm ready to leave. I transfer them into that bucket, and because we're 10, 15 minutes from home, it's plenty of time to get them home and let them go. And of all the fish that we keep, bullheads are the ones, like, I think you could put bullheads in a bucket with no water as long as they weren't too hot for 10 to 15 minutes, bring them home, throw them in the water, they'll probably all live. They are so tough. They are so tough. Jim S. says that bubbler that I recommended is on my site at tspaz.com. I've had one a couple of years, and I love it. And I kill them, Jim, to be honest with you, because they last a long time if you do two things, freshwater fish only, and take the batteries out of them when you're not using them. I'm pretty good about taking the battery out of them when I'm not using them. But I take those to Sanibel, Florida when we go down there, and I'll be on like 10, 15 days on the beach with them. And they usually don't make it after they get that much exposure to salt. But they're like $10. And, you know, you save a ton of money by having them versus not having them. If you use them the way I'm talking about or probably the way Jim's doing, they last a long time. And the amount of air they produce is kind of crazy. If you compare them to, like, a Whisper 1000 aquarium pump for a 10-gallon fish aquarium, and you put them side by side with a stone, you're like, how does this little damn thing do this? And how do they last so long? I've had, and they take 2D batteries, and that pretty much extends how long they'll run for you. But if you put 1D battery in, they'll work for better part of a full 24-hour day on 1D battery. That's pretty impressive. And if you have rechargeable AA's, then you can buy the D battery adapters. You put 3 AA's inside them. You have rechargeable Ds, and they won't last as long, obviously, as a regular D battery. They don't have the capacity, but they will last plenty, plenty long. You also want knife, pliers, and a rag. Keeping your hands clean is you're in a situation a lot of times, these creeks and all, you can't, like, if you're at a lake, you can usually just bend over and wash your hands in the water. A lot of these creeks, you have steeper banks and all. So if you're dealing with that, you might want to use heavier than necessary fishing test line as far as your pounds of weight because you have to hoist fish up a bank or something, and you can't get your hands clean as easily. So having a rag, and especially when you're dealing with bullheads, I try to touch them as little as possible, not because I don't want to touch them, but because you really get nasty hands dealing with a lot of them if you can't really wash off well. That's a good case for having a rope on that bucket. So even if you're not keeping the fish in the bucket, you can throw that bucket down, pull it up. Now you can clean things with the water. Very, very nice. But a rag will be very, very helpful. A lot of times with bullheads, what I'll do is I'll grab the hook with one pair of pliers, grab the lip with another, and then into whatever they're going, either back to the water. Not because I'm afraid to touch them. I've been taking these things off with my bare hands forever. I've got, you know, bullheads really don't hurt that bad to get stabbed by. It's just getting stabbed. It's like somebody stabbing you with a toothpick or something. It's not fun, but it's not long-term painful. I've got scars from saltwater catfish. Gaff topsails and hardhead catfish, they have some level of a venom in their slime. It's not enough to make you go to the hospital, but it freaking hurts, and it literally will leave, like, what looks, I guess you can't really see it, that right there. At the bottom of my pinky, bottom joint of my pinky, it looks like a freckle. That is from a saltwater catfish right there, if you're looking at the video. And I've got a good 5 or 6 places, like, right there on my hand where I've been hit with those. So I'm not afraid of them. It's just I like to keep my hands as clean as possible. It makes everything else you're doing a lot easier. And I drive a nice car, and I don't want it to smell like fish because I touch things when I get back in my car. But knife pliers and a rag and insect repellent, especially just, man, you know, even these faster moving little bodies of water, there's always little back eddies and stuff. So they're mosquito breeding grounds. On that, remember what I said about bullheads? They smell with their body. Put your insect repellent on at home. Wash your hands really well, so that when you're touching bait, you're not transferring the smell of DEET to your bait, because I've seen that absolutely shit can people's results catching fish, especially catfish. They smell it and they don't like it. Something's wrong. Some things to consider when you find your spot. Where am I going to fish? And this is where I'm going to try to make sure that when I explain some of these things, unlike I kind of feel like earlier when I did it with the maps, those of you on the audio didn't get much out of it. I'm going to try to make sure you do with this. But going fast, shade is your friend. You stay cool and you cast no shadow. So overpasses are great, 100% shade. The fish don't, they can look out of the water and see you, but you don't cast a shadow into the water. Fish get very in tune with their surroundings, and they know, like, this shadow kind of grows during the day and what have you. And when a shadow they're not familiar with pops up, that's danger. That's something trying to kill me. Think about your little fish in creek. What eats you? Almost every aquatic bird that comes near you, other bigger fish, snakes, right? There's all kinds of things that eat you. And those big monkey-looking things with no hair, right? That's us. They're afraid of that. So shade is your friend. It also helps them stay cool. Fish love in the heat of the summer to get in the shade. There's a place I used to fish on. This is big water, Joe Pool Lake. It's about an 8,000-acre reservoir. And I used to catch white bass right in the middle of the day when nobody could catch them. And it was so stupid simple that I was always afraid people would figure out what I was doing, and it seemed like nobody ever did. There's a bridge that went across a narrow part of the lake. The water was about 22 foot deep, and that's where the thermocline sets in Texas in the summer. So just above that thermocline is where fish would lay. The bridge cast a shadow. And all I would do is troll with something called a hell pet. You have to look up to see what that is. A hell pet at about 2 miles an hour, and I would stay in that shade. And I could go out there and catch a limit of white bass in the absolute middle of the summer. I'm in the shade. The fish are in the shade. Everybody's happy. You moved over 20 feet where you're not in the shade of that bridge anymore, you can catch shit. But when that shade moved out to that spot 2 hours later, that's where they were. So the fish like I consider shade a form of structure. Fishing's about structure, overhangs, ledges, drop-offs, brush piles, rock piles. That's all structure. Culverts and shade are also forms of structure. Casting upstream, usually, not always, it depends on where you can get to, what's there, etc. You got a big hole downstream and you can't really get to it from the other side, by all means cast down into it, okay? Drift down into it, etc. But if you can cast, you're better off casting upstream and bringing your bait back down. Why? One, that's how current works, and that's how things that like you know, bugs and worms and shit that falls in creeks, that's the direction it goes. But the other side of it is most of the time fish will face upstream. So you're bringing bait to them, and that's why they're doing it. They're sitting there in ambush mode. They also aren't looking at you. So it's a general rule, not an always rule. Overhanging brush, rocks, etc. are always, always good to look at. And one thing I left out in the gear, one of the things I always take with me, now I don't know that I would go out and buy these for fishing. But this is a pair of Felco pruners. I use this on my property for pruning trees and stuff like that. And I have a sheath for them, so I'll take these with me. I'll put them in my fishing bag. Because when you're fishing, a lot of times, you know, overhangs are good and all, but there's that one overhang. that there's like three people's fishing line tied up in, and you think you can get underneath it, and as soon as you cast, you get it wrapped around it, or that one access place you come in, that branch hits you in the face all the time, prune it out. And I, when I'm going out scouting and I'm not even going to fish, I will take these with me. And if I'm like, oh, I'm going to go try this place, that's in my way, I'll clear it out. If I'm fishing on one side and there's like an overhang and it's not worth my time to go, you know, go back up, go around, come down the other side and prune it off while I'm fishing, but I like the place and I'm going to come back, I'll do that when I leave. This is a hell of a good thing. You know, you probably don't want to be taking a sawzall or something out there, though. You know, you might go do that at a time when you're not fishing or something. If there's just something really in the way, get it out of the way. It's really, really simple. And the other thing about these that's really great is a lot of times when I'm fishing, I try to go minimalist like this, carry less shit in so I don't bring rod holders or whatever. You can make a rod holder really, really quick. And you can do a good job because you can prune the bottom of that rod holder at an angle so it will stick into the ground. So a pair of these, even like cheap Coronas or something like that, is a really good idea. It's not going overboard to keep like a folding bow saw, like a bow saw, but it's not really a bow saw. I don't know what you call them, a little folding saw, a little hand saw in your vehicle anyway. And so, again, you might not while you're fishing, but like this was a good place. I want to come back. That one freaking, and anybody that's done this knows why I'm getting a little irritated. We all know that freaking one branch. If that damn branch wasn't there, I could, you know what I'm saying? Clear that shit out. But always look for overhangs, holes. Usually have a shallow side and a deep side. And fishing kind of these cutout banks is often effective. I'm going to show you a few stills from some other folks' videos here in a second and talk about this a little bit more. But a lot of times you'll find a creek, you got skinny water, and then you got a hole, and you go back to that skinny water, but one side, and often it's the side that's easier to get to, like 2 feet out, the water is still a couple inches deep. But way against the far bank, you're going to be on the outside of a bend. You have like a cutout and a deep spot. Those are always freaking dead on places to try. Like if you don't get any fish out of there, you probably need a new spot, or that spot, you're at the wrong time of year. That same Eagle Mountain Lake, I found one of the feeder creeks that comes away to the north. I went up there. Clearly people fish their ass off up there. My guess is it's during the white bass spawning. They come out of that lake and they go up that creek to spawn. I couldn't buy a fish out of that place in the summertime. It looked wonderful. I mean, I couldn't get a bluegill to peck at a worm for 2.5 hours. I gave up and I've not been back. I bet there's another time of year to fish there, though. So it's either the wrong place or the wrong time at the wrong place when you're in that situation. But you want to find those deep cutouts. Culverts are always good bets. And I got a little video thing where I can show you some of it. But if you see a culvert and water goes up into it, there's fish in there. I've seen tons of videos on YouTube of dudes. There's a culvert. The water goes across the road up the other side. You can't even get to the water. There's a freaking like a sewer cover, but one you can fit through. And I've seen them pull fish out of there like crazy. They love that protection, especially, again, the summer, the heat. It's a cooler spot. Where do you want to be when it's 106 degrees, in the sun or the shade? Fish feel the same way about it. Culverts are always a good bet. And again, I mentioned this at the beginning, but if you find places where there's like it looks like a little pond, right? And it's isolated and it seems too small to really hold fish, check it out. You might be surprised. If it's still holding water late in the summer during your dry season, it's connected to something when it's wet season. And those fish will migrate up into there, and they'll get trapped. And a lot of times, you're saving their lives. You're saving their lives by catching them if you're going to take them somewhere else. Because eventually, that is going to dry up or get too shallow or too low oxygen or not enough food, and those fish are all going to die. And when they're trapped in those places, you can't not catch them. I mean, you just can't not catch them. And it's I'll put it this way. When I lived in Florida as a kid, we lived in a huge apartment complex, and the backside of it was adults only, and we rode our bikes over there all the time anyway, and as long as we didn't cause any trouble, everybody left us alone. And that's where the tennis courts were. And when we get really heavy rains there, which we got in the summer there, the one court was on an area low enough that like half the court would be covered with a couple inches of water. And we were stupid kids. It was the '80s and hurting yourself was acceptable as a kid back then. We used to take our BMX bikes and drive around as fast as we could in that water. And eventually, because you're on that, you know, that kind of paving that a tennis court has, like smooth paint. Like it's like riding a bicycle on ice. And it was basically just to wipe out and see like how fast could you go before you wiped out on the court. And we would mock each other and crash into each other and shit. There were freaking minnows. I don't know what kind they were. These things were awesome. I've never been able, if anybody can tell me what the species of this fish is, I would love to know. There's male and female, obviously. The male were colorful, which is pretty common. The males had a blue tail, and their head was orange, and they had like a white crown. They were a huge minnow. They would be swimming all over that freaking court while we were there driving our bicycles around, and occasionally you'd find a dead one, but most of the time they would go with the water to recede. If fish will move up onto a tennis court, what the hell will they not move on to? Anyway, let's move on here. And I want to show you just a few spots. And this is from a video by a guy. I think it's called Creek Fishing Adventure or something like that. I'll add his channel. I really like him. Most of what you're about to see is from one video of his, like where he took a whole bunch of like the best parts of all his videos and put them together in like 2 hours of all this kind of skinny water. And I want to show you kind of this first spot and tell you what I see as an opportunity here. So this is a very small creek that he was fishing right in the middle of a town. All kinds of people all over the place, houses, businesses, et cetera. It's, you know, there's nothing really there for scale, but that's probably 8 foot across. And it's concrete on both sides of it. On the far side, there's a piece of concrete that's a couple inches underwater, and it comes out about a foot, and then there's a ledge underneath it, and that water, he said, is about 2 foot deep. It looks shallower, but it's just very clear water at the time of the year. Okay, that ledge, there's fish under there. There's fish. I guarantee you there's fish under there, and if there's bullheads in this water, and there probably are, there's bullheads under there. That is prime habitat. If I'm fishing from the side this is viewed where I'm looking across to it, then I'm actually going to cast on top of that ledge. Very slowly bring the bait and let it fall right at the edge. If I'm on the other side, I'm going to just kind of bring it back up to it and let it sit just outside there. Now, you can't see it in this particular frame, but where you see there's like a willow tree branch to the left, there's a big blowdown, a big clump there. Let me see if I can just move this back. Yeah, right there. Okay, so that's just above where I was just showing you. He pulled a bunch of fish out of there, too. Actually, that's the other side. But anything like you're looking at there is a really good place to check out. And again, this guy's Creek Fishing Adventures is who he is. Now, here, he caught a bunch of bass here. This is between two sides of a divided highway in Oklahoma. This guy gets around with all his little fishing like this. And he caught a ton of black bass in this. And this is one of those places where, and right now, they're not trapped. But there's a creek on the other side of that far road, and you've got a culvert coming through it. And what ends up happening is these fish move up through that culvert into this pond, but eventually they'll get cut off. But he's fishing kind of this grass line that's on the near side. I would do everything in the world to get along the wall of that culvert. It's one of these culverts that's more square than round, and it kind of juts out on 245s. Those ledges on those walls on the outside of that culvert are money, and then inside those culverts are money. And there's another thing going on in this picture. Remember I said shaded structure? Where the sun's located in front of that culvert is in the shade right now from the rise of the bank and the culvert itself. So not just in the culvert, but in that shaded area in front of the culvert, those are areas I would want to fish. Next up, this is a really tiny, tiny little space here, but I wanted you to just get a view of this. And again, about a minute 24, an hour 24, hour 22, if you're going to find this spot from the audio version. What I want you to see there, though, is as small as this is, there is a hole there, and you've got skinny water to, you know, on the down creek side where the water's flowing to. And if you saw the whole video, you got it. So this is an isolated hole, and he pulled a bunch of fish out of there. I would definitely fish that spot. And again, you can see there's cars everywhere. People are probably looking at this guy like he's crazy fishing there. And then this is right here was one of, this is somebody else's video, but it's a perfect example of what I was talking about with the holes on larger creeks, especially. One side is dead shallow. This spot, for those not being able to see it, is probably 15 foot at the widest spot across. 5 foot out in the water, you can see the gravel. That water's probably 6 inches deep, but I bet you that water on that bank, you wouldn't want to fall in there. Your ass is soaking wet. You're going to go down deep. That's another spot that you'd really want to check out if you were fishing out of that body of water. So I hope that kind of helps you to think about how to look and see water. And this is something you're only going to learn with experience. And here I'll tell you a little story, a fun little story. There's a friend of mine I went to high school with named Mike. We called him Mikey. And he was an interesting character, but he was a decent fisherman. And one day we were fishing a creek, a lot like what I'm showing you here, except this creek was a mountain creek, central Pennsylvania, and there was a lot of native brook trout in it. There were also a lot of chubs and other things in it. And I'm catching fish, and he's not. And he's like, there's no fish here. I'm like, Mike, you're not that bad of a fisherman. What are you doing? And this is something you can do too if the water's safe to do this in any way. We would fish there, old pair of tennis shoes, shorts, no socks, walk in the water. Because, you know, in the summer you don't need hip boots and you sweat your ass off in hip boots in the summer. So we would just walk in the water. And we start walking along the stretch. We get to like a next hole area, pockets and stuff. And I'm like, catch fish. And I'd be like, no, right there. And he'd cast where I pointed, but not where I was saying. And I'd be like, no, watch. And I pulled fish after fish after, and these are brook trout on worms in front of this guy over and over again. And he just couldn't see what I was like, okay, right there. You see that eddy behind that rock? And he was in the right general area, but I'm like, no, I mean right here. And I dropped that line there and pull a fish out right in front of him. You'll learn that in time. You'll see things in time that tell you this is a spot. Sometimes they're really obvious. When you go under a bridge, there's a big hole and there's fish looking at you, that's a good spot. But as you start exploring, you'll start seeing these little spots and you'll know, like that brush pile right there, if I go just behind that edge of it, I don't know what to call it. It's almost like a fish spider sense or something, but like you just know. You just know there's a fish there. There's times when you make a cast like that and it's hard to get into and that line drops right and you're like, oh, I deserve a fish. Just by hitting it. And usually you get one. You know, not always, but usually you'll get one. But unless you literally live in the desert somewhere, you can find spots like this. I mean, I did it for you with the map portion of this podcast, right? Like I pulled up places. I've never really been to Nashville, never really been to Atlanta. Find three or four potential spots in a couple minutes time using the technique I showed you. I'm not saying all those spots would be good. I'm saying one of them was. And if I were to sit there and pick a 10-mile radius in any one of these areas and pick out 20 spots, half of them are going to be good. Half of them are going to be good. You can learn to do this. And it opens up so much more opportunity because, you know, to me, I'm just going to fish more if it's easy to do. If I can go out for an hour and a half and come home, I will. I'm not going to the lake for an hour and a half. I'm not loading up the boat for an hour and a half. I'm not hiring a guide for an hour and a half. I'm not driving an hour to fish for an hour and a half. But drop my kids off, fish for an hour, hour and a half on the way home, come home and make dinner? Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that. So this is a legit survival skill. It really is. There's, you know, when I think about this, like, I did a lot of this when I was a kid for food. I don't really do it for food now, other than they do end up stocking my little aquatic systems and all. When I was a kid growing up in Florida and Pennsylvania, we never had a lot of money. And I wasn't the only one doing it. Like, I had a lot of friends and all. We would go out and you'd come home with fish, and that was fine. You were off screwing off all day in the summer and not doing any work at home. If you came home with fish, you were good. You came home with nothing, what were you doing all day? This was a subsistence thing. If you go back into like we mentioned hobos a couple of times, and they're just isn't hobos like there used to be. And I said there's a difference between a hobo and a tramp. You can look that up, but most of the hobos aren't what we have this mindset of back in the golden age of hobos, right? Which would be from about the Civil War up until about the 1940s or 50s. You know, the riding the rails and all that. a lot of these guys, especially like coming up into and through the Great Depression, they were workers. They just traveled to look for work. And every damn one of them, I guarantee you, was carrying a little fishing kit like this and surviving off of it, or at least augmenting what they were eating off of it. So a lot of them were sending money home. You know, they weren't what we think of when we think of this. With that, let's see if we can take a few questions. I think I've got five marked. If I'm missing anything, right, if I'm missing any questions, re-ask them, question or comment in the subject line. I'll do what I can. Going fast, Richard says, hit that like button. 42 watching, only 4 likes. Yikes. I agree, Richard. Please hit the like button. That helps me a lot, and it'll make it more likely you'll see my videos when they come out and you miss the live. The new old man says, I have a 700-gallon galvanized tank, 2 feet deep. What fish do you recommend to farm, or should I buy? Should I bury it? If you can bury it, I would at least halfway. Your thermal gradient will be better if it's in the ground and has good ground contact. It'll help keep the water cooler. And I would also try to locate that somewhere in the shade when you did that, at least most of the time in the shade. And ideally, you would have sun hitting it in the winter and shade in the summer. So if you have a deciduous tree that you can locate that near. What fish do I recommend? Bluegills and bullheads. And I would really say, in a single tank like that of that size, probably bluegills or bullheads, because one will consume the other. The bullheads will eat the bluegills. It's one of their favorite things, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, is it? A lot of times I throw bluegills into one of my ponds, and I'm like, those channel catfish are going to eat you. And the ones that don't get eaten get really big. And the ones that get eaten make the channel catfish get really big. I will tell you there's a learning curve to the to keeping fish alive. And you want two, not one pump. Two pumps. You can have one lesser pump that does less work, but you can even have that pump on some sort of intermittent timer or something like that. But when you see that one pump's not working, you turn it on full, and that gives you time to replace it. And I recommend your primary pump standardize on a single pump, a certain model. That way, replacing it's very quick, because all the pipe and everything is the right size and length and everything, and have a second pump on the shelf as a spare part. And when that, and sooner or later it will die. And when your primary pump dies, take the one off the shelf, install it, and buy another backup. I really, really recommend that. Liberty Guard says, Jack, I caught a cat in a pond. The fillets were good, but I found a worm inside the fish. Is it still good to eat? When you see visible parasites in a fish, I would generally decide I'm not going to eat that fish. You can remove them. And if you cook them sufficiently, you're just eating, you know, a cooked worm instead of a raw worm. There is some risk of like tapeworm and stuff like that. But most of what you're going to find in fish, you don't want it in your body alive. But if it's cooked, it will be safe. I just prefer not to. I prefer not to. One of the species that I will eat that a lot of people also think is a garbage fish, a saltwater fish, is hardhead catfish, which are, you know, saltwater catfish. They're nasty. They're disgusting. You've never eaten one prepared properly. And you can ruin any fish by preparing it improperly. But a lot of times I will fillet one of those and I will find parasites in those more than any other fish I've ever found them in. And when I do that, they become cut bait. I don't eat them. There's enough of them around that I don't eat them. Another question here, this one is from Adventure Frog. It said, dealing with box turtles, especially when Karens are around. Well, I think we're using the wrong word here, because I think what we're talking about is dealing with turtles, not box turtles. Box turtles are actually a species of tortoise, not a turtle. They live on land, and they very seldom go in water, and they're never a problem. They're the ones that you pick them up, they call them a box turtle because they close up both ends, and they're cool to find. And, you know, one thing I'll say about them is transplanting them doesn't seem to work. I brought home like 30 of them one year when we lived in Pennsylvania and let them go on my grandparents' place. I never saw one there. I don't know where the hell they went. I think he means like red ears and sliders and green turtles and stuff like that live in the ponds that are constantly stealing your bait and biting shit. You want less of them to be there and you want them to go away. I don't have a good answer for that. You just have to be careful with what you're doing if you do that. but a lot of the park ponds really need them thinned out. One of the little pond I showed you at Central Park and White Settlement, there are one of the reasons I don't fish there as much as I would otherwise is every third thing is a turtle on a line. And one of the reasons I went from like the mesh laundry basket to the metal fish basket is the damn turtles will try to get the fish out of the basket. That can be a real problem. I don't have a good answer for that in like ranches and farms with stock tanks. You know, there's worse ways to spend a couple hours than sitting in the shade on the bank with a 22 and picking heads off. I'll say that. And you can make traps. Turtle traps are basically like a basket that sits below the water level with like a plank where they can climb up to sun themselves. And when they jump off, they end up inside the basket and be removed. But if you're talking about places where you have people that might be upset about what you're doing, I don't have a great answer for that. Maybe somebody in the audience does. Last one, Rachel says, do you think yarrow tincture would scare off fish? I found out yarrow tincture is an insect repellent. The answer is I don't know, Rachel. I'm really not sure. I would actually be more worried about what else might be in it. The best natural insect repellent that I've ever found is lemon balm. And I've not found lemon balm like to really turn fish off at all either. And all you do with that is take a good handful of fresh lemon balm and just rub it all over your head, your neck, your face, your arms, and it works pretty good. I stick to using, and we're just, you know, where you live, I know where you live, Rachel. You live up in Pennsylvania. There's some mosquitoes there. But the mosquitoes in the South are a whole different level of vicious. And so I use Deep Woods Off. I spray it on before I leave the house, and I wash my hands really good. Let's see if any other questions came in while I answered those. It doesn't look like it. So as I'm closing up, if you had a question I missed, you can go ahead and repost it if you're still here. With that, I do want to remind you guys that you can help support the show and the work that we do if you do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. Today's item of the day is the same one I had yesterday, but the show went so long, I didn't even really talk about it at all, but it is Diablo's 12-inch pruning reciprocating saw blades, and I kind of mentioned something like this, but it has nothing to do with today's episode. It's summer. It's hot as heck out. It's going to be fall before you know it. Dove season, opening day of dove season, is like a week and a half away for a lot of people. That's kind of the advent of fall. Kids are back in school here in the South. Up north, they're going back in another couple of weeks. If October, it's hard to believe, but October is 1 month and 11 days away. October's fall. And so this is when we start thinking about pruning and things like that. And these are the best tool for pruning. It's small tree, slag, et cetera, removal. I have several chainsaws. I have electric chainsaws. I have plug-in electric chainsaws. I got a Husqvarna, a Farm Boss. But most of the time, when I have little tree work that needs doing, I use the Sawzall. I use my DeWalt Sawzall, and I use these Diablo blades. The blade pattern on them looks an awful lot like the blade pattern on a bow saw. That's intentional. They're about $5 a blade. You get a lot of use out of them before you toss them out. And they're just safer, and they're safer because a reciprocating saw, when you let go of the trigger, the blade stops moving. And it's almost impossible to, you know, it's not impossible, but it's almost impossible. It's highly improbable unless it's a certain situation where, like, you're reaching to get a limb that you're not putting two hands on the saw. And that keeps two hands on the saw, and that means the blade's never moving when you let go because when you let go, the blade stops. They're lightweight, they're quiet, they only use energy when you're actively cutting something, except we all know any man, you put the battery in the saw, you have to do it a couple, like if you don't do that, they take your man card away. But these are a great blade, check them out, you can find them on the website or at tspaz.com, and they make your life a little bit easier. And if you do have that one big ass limb in your way, where your little fishing hole is, you found out, that's a great way to get rid of it. Get in, get out, and come back later if you think it's going to be a problem, if you have any caring issues like we were asked about. Anyway, guys, hope you enjoyed today's show. Oops says blades can be sharpened. You want to sit around and sharpen that little last blade after it's been used long enough to need it? You go ahead. My issue with that, I'll say that just real quick. If you had to, if you're in a time of shortage, whatever, go ahead. Reciprocating saw blades, when they've been used long enough to really get dull, especially not cutting metal, cutting wood, they get pretty hot, and that steel starts to lose temper at a point where I think you're kind of spinning your wheels. If blades were $50, it'd be different. But I mean, I've used one of those blades for like a whole season, and I'm out $5. I just replace it with a new one. With that, well, that's a good little thing. Jim says Food Forest Farms is great fishing coffee. Yeah, take your coffee with you or take a beer with you. I'll let you know a little secret, too. If you do want to have a beer or two, now, I don't believe in going out fishing getting drunk because there's all kinds of things that can go wrong and you need to have your wits about you. But, you know, having a beer or three over a few hours, not a bad way to spend some time fishing. You know that they make, for you guys to drink beer out of cans, it looks like Coke or Dr. Pepper or Pepsi, and it just goes around your beer can. That's a thing. They exist. I'm just letting you know that you do with that information what you will. So it looks like your cooler full of Cokes, and it's actually full of, you know, some good beer here or there, just so you know. With that, take care. Appreciate y'all tuning in today. Tomorrow we'll have an interview show. Then we'll have an expert counsel Q&A, and we'll do a Friday flashback. We'll be out for another week. Take care, guys. Catch you tomorrow with another one.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.